Exactly 8 years ago, someone sent an open letter to the president decrying the drug situation in El Dorado Park. Her son happened to be an addict, and she was just, quite frankly, to put it mildly, gutful of the situation. And that's not an endorsement of a particular political group. It's just, you know, a term to basically put it out there that she was sick and tired of what was going on within a community, within her own family. And I should say, because of familiar links to El Dorado Park, we saw sort of immediately or soon after the release of that letter, we saw massive, massive changes, you know, police being everywhere, you know, at the entrances, lolly lounges were shut down. Now, for people that don't know what a lolly lounge ultimately is, for lack of a better term, it's a derelict home where you find children and girls in particular being used for sex while people are engaging in all kinds of drugs. And, you know, that for me was unfortunately the tragic story around, you know, how drugs can impact a community. But Darlene James took this as an opportunity to highlight not just her personal plight, but the plight of an entire community, and thereby started her journey of activism. And we're very lucky to be joined by her on the line just to talk a little bit about, you know, what she has done, what she's currently doing, and, you know, how do we start dealing with these issues, and what are some of the things that we actually need within communities to bring this scourge to an end? Because I think what people really, depending on where you live and under what circumstances you live, it's very difficult to relate to the notion that, you know, you could have your entire community overtaken by drugs and end up with a massive, massive issue, from crime, you know, peripheral crimes, all the way through to the social issues that we have to deal with when dealing with this issue as well. And I think I'm really looking forward to that particular conversation, seeing how it can go forward. Of course, if you want to contribute to the conversation, if you want to say something kind, please do give us a shout on the line on 011-883-0702, as well as 021-446-0567. Just to tell you a little more about Darlene, she is the founder and CEO of Yellow Ribbon Foundation, El Dorado Park, of El Dorado Park, and named one of South Africa's top 100 change makers and 702 lead SA hero after her pleading letter to former President Jacob Zuma. And 2 weeks ago, she was inaugurated by Minister of Social Development for Central Drug Authorities. Good evening there, Darlene, and thank you for joining us this evening and sharing in your, you know, in a very important conversation this evening. Darlene, can you hear me?
Yes, I think I just got the last two words of whatever you were saying.
Oh, okay.
That's what I got.
So basically, you're saying that I'm boring you to death, and I should. I'm just joking. Darlene, good evening, and thank you for joining us this evening. And thank you for, I think, highlighting a plight, a very important plight that has been ignored for a very, very long time.
Thank you so much. Thank you for having me on your show tonight.
Great stuff. Darlene, let's start off with where this all starts back in 2013. I mean, I think a lot of people are aware of the story. But some of them might need a bit of a refresher course, for lack of a better term. May 2013, you wrote a letter to the president. What led to you writing that particular letter?
I think, yes, although it was addressed to the then president, it wasn't actually, it was just a letter written out of desperation and sort of not knowing what to do. And it was just me putting my notions and my feelings on. You know, just writing, because when I do feel a bit pressurized and stressed out, I often just write. And I think that particular evening, I'd wrote it on my, I think I still had a BlackBerry back then, and I just started writing and expressing how I felt. And I sent it to a friend of mine, and a friend sent it to a friend. And I think it wasn't me actually sending the letter to the president. I think it was just South Africans and people who could relate, who then started sending it to the presidency, and that's how it actually happened. And 2 weeks later, I remember getting a call from the then spokesperson, Mac Maharaj, saying that the president has received your letter and he's coming to Aldo's, and that's how it all started.
I mean, and you know, it literally just tells us about also the inaccessibility of our leaders at times, that you sort of went to that extent of going and writing this letter in the hope that someone could deliver this letter for you. But it reached, you know, the president. It became a viral sensation before we even, you know, understood what a viral sensation is. I remember we were, talking about it here on 702. I know that, you know, there was a massive, I think, if I'm not mistaken, Darlene, you'll correct me if I'm wrong. John Robbie came and did an outside broadcast in El Dorado Park. And because I have family in the area, you know, I remembered, you know, some of the moves and the shakes and the things that happened. What happened in that period? The president obviously went there, as politicians do. What happened after that?
I think it was crazy at the time. I mean, at first I couldn't believe that the actual president was coming to Aldo's. I mean, who am I after all, you know? And I think that letter was written because of the many challenges that I was facing, closed doors, you know, going to social development, trying at rehabs and at NGOs, police, I just given up hope, basically. And I think I was at my wit's end thinking, who next, you know, who do I try, where can I get help? And that is why I wrote that letter and I addressed it as Dear Dad, you know, because even just saying Mr. President, I'm sure he gets many letters saying Mr. President. And I thought that he needs to relate in terms of a father and understand this, you know, as if though it was his child. And that is why I said Dear Dad in that letter. And when they came, like you rightfully just said, it went viral. I mean, 702 was basically leading this, you know, the desperate mother from El Dorado Park. I remember John always saying the desperate mother from what is happening there, because I highlighted not only my plight, but the more I spoke to people in my community, the more I realized that I wasn't the only one that was going through this. There was many, many, many dozens, hundreds, thousands of other families that was basically suffering in silence because of the stigma as well. And weeks later, he came to El Dorado Park. He first said, you know, he spoke, I think it was also his assistant, Bongani, back then, said to me, you know what, Dee, whenever we turned on the radio, whenever we looked at the television, there you were, the desperate mother from El Dorado Park. But I think that was South Africans that could relate, that was pushing this, you know, and media. And the president came, he spoke to myself and a few mothers that day, I remember, at the church, and later on he addressed the larger community. And many promises were made, and I was very hopeful at that time. I mean, I was just an ordinary community, you know, just a mother in desperate need of help and relief, you know. And I actually believed everything that was said that day. I remember everyone was in tears. I was so naive at the time. Before I addressed him that morning, I remember saying, like, what do I even call him? Do I call him Mr. President? Do I call him Mr. Zuma or what? And I then said, you know what, I just need, because he came with an entire entourage. It was the president. It was a whole lot of ministers, Martin Tetwa, it was Nomvula. It was everyone. And I said to them, I said, guys, I just need you to understand and listen to me as moms, as mothers and fathers. And I think when they shifted and took off their hats as officials and they sort of did that, you know, there was a great sense of remorse, of understanding. And, you know, I remember everyone was in tears that morning just listening to what we have to endure and go through, you know, not having peace. And the president went out after that and he addressed the community and he said, I can still remember, if we don't respond to this plight, if we don't do anything, after having listened to the horrendous story that I heard today, then we cannot call ourselves a government. We cannot call ourselves a government if we don't act swiftly. We cannot call ourselves a government if we don't come to the rescue of this community. And it's actually still on YouTube, you know? And it was guns blazing for about 3 months. It was all government departments in El Dorado Park.
So what I'm going to do is, if you don't mind, I'm going to ask you to pause there, because I actually want to flesh that out a little bit. Because as I said, I witnessed that. I saw that, you know, you'd drive into El Dorado Park and you'd see the big police hippo and the vans and people were being pulled over and cars were being searched. And, you know, it was a police state in El Dorado Park for quite some time. And then suddenly, you know, if I had to go back tomorrow and go see the in-laws, guess what? I'm not going to see any of that. You know, at best, it's a couple of Metro Police or traffic police pulling people over and checking for expired tickets or whatever the case may be. Let's start off by talking and looking at what it is that led you to sending that desperate plea, that letter to the president. What was your own personal experience that led you to be so desperate to say that, listen, I really need to just express myself and I need to get help?
I think it was...
Darylene?
Hello, can you hear me?
Yeah, you just dropped off a little bit there, but yeah, you back?
It was a mother's determination of not wanting to bury her son.
Mm.
It was that. It was something that was bigger than me. It was something that, you know, when your child says to you, Mom, I have a headache or a tummy ache, you know exactly what to do. You can get some meds from the chemist. You can take them to the doctor.
Mm.
But this drugs, who would have thought that it would come knocking on my door? And I thought after the first rehab, and you probably just go to an expensive rehab and that's the end of your problems. I did not understand that it's a lifelong mental disorder. And with me having spent so much money making loans upon loans, knocking down doors, at the stage, I think I was more addicted to my son's addiction than anything else because my life went backwards. I was hopeless. I wasn't taking care of myself. I wasn't doing my hair. I wasn't socializing.
Mm.
I just became so addicted. It, you know, walking the streets of El Dorado Park at night, putting on my All Stars and a Bataclava, going to look for him. It was just a dark time in my life. It almost felt like I was dead already. I wasn't living. And, you know, all your attention and all your focus is just on this one person. And I think it's so heartbreaking and people won't understand because you see this person that looks like the person that you gave birth to, but, you know, when the drug comes, it's just not that person. So you actually move between...
Darylene, I'm just going to ask you to move back into the position that you were in earlier. Unfortunately, I think it's load shedding. It's a whole bunch of factors, but it's unfortunately impacting the line every now and again. But what I'm going to ask you is, what was your son addicted to and what are some of the issues that you had to deal with? Because, you know, again, it's one of those where I guess one can generalize and there are certain expectations, there are certain things that one anticipates would happen under these circumstances when someone is dealing with addiction. But what are some of the issues that you had to deal with as a parent to your son addicted to you know, whatever drug it may have been?
It was stuck at the time, and it's one of the worst drugs to get addicted to. And I'm not sure if you've watched the Ellen Puckis movie. It was exactly that. Mm. You know, it was stealing. It was screaming at night. It was hallucinations. It was just an awful time. And I sometimes don't even want to reflect on that because I've grown beyond that. You know, the story that I now want to tell is, you know, how if you want change, you need to be the change.
Mm.
You know, I think for me that's more important instead of being stuck there. I've made peace with it. But what I do want to say that years later, he's matriculated 2 years ago. He got his matric. He's 25 years old and he's doing a hell of a lot better.
That's very good. I'm very happy to hear that. Now let's look at the community itself. And obviously, this was not something in isolation. I mean, your letter, your heartfelt letter, wasn't saying that, please, can you do something for my son? Yes, of course, your son was part of the group. It was part of the collective that needed assistance. But ultimately, it boiled down to a community effort. I mean, there were many things that you had highlighted during that period. I mean, especially, and I was with 702 at the time, by the way. I'm
2013.
Yeah. I do my thing at night, Darylene. you know, obviously, so during that particular period, you know, I listened to your story quite a bit. And you know, you were telling the stories of what some of the issues were within El Dorado Park. Number one, what was the issues then, the social issues and the problems that you had to deal with as a community? And what does it look like now? Is it very similar? Has it changed at all? Has it improved?
I think there was an attempt at change, but it was an attempt at change by doing tick boxes, meeting targets, not in terms of really, you know, a sustainable plan. It was, we need to show what we have done, and we have done, and that is it. I remember back then in the National Drug Master Plan, I think it was, who was the Social Development Minister, Dlamini? Mm. And she actually said that the intervention in El Dorado Park will sort of be the pilot for the rest of the country. And today, 8-9 years later, I'm still asking, what is this pilot in El Dorado Park? Because the some of the stuff that I highlighted in that letter is the fact that there hasn't been development in this area for most of my life that I've been living in El Dorado, and that's over 40 years. And I spoke about the long grass. I spoke about the schools, the state of our schools, the fences, it's been vandalized. I remember highlighting the fact that the taps are gone at the schools and girls cannot even go to school during their period because the copper taps have been stolen, the handles from the windows have been stolen, the drains, the lids are all open, the picket-up bins get stolen to transport stolen goods in it at night. You hear the wheels of picket-ups at 3-2 o'clock in the morning. And I also spoke about our young girls that have gone from education and a proper meal, and you find us having to take out a young 13-year-old from a lolly lounge, you know, today, and a week later she's reported missing again. And these guys actually selling these girls for sexual favors, and them just not wanting to return home, and that was the current state. And even if we do get these girls out of the lolly lounges, some of them are HIV positive. You know, so that was the state of the community, where you have children going into their mothers' homes and throwing TVs down the second floor of the flats. It was a mother stabbing her daughter in her leg because she stole her slippers. It was a young boy of 15 smashing his dad's car because he's high and he's hallucinating. It was calling SAPS to all these scenes and SAPS saying, this is a domestic affair, you know, we can't do anything. It was calling ambulance to come in and assist us, and then saying, no, we can't contain this person because they're too violent, they're going to smash the equipment in the ambulance. It was that sort of thing. It was reaching out to a social worker and her saying, why are you late, without her understanding that this person has a mental illness. And there was just so much going wrong, and it was just a great sense of despair in the community. And today, you know, after I'd written the letter, I remember, I actually spoke about this earlier on today, and I remember that a memo was sent out to all schools saying, how does government help, you know, from education, and principals received phones and tablets, and some repairs were done to the schools. I remember we got veteran social workers into our community and they assisted, but without actually understanding addiction, without actually understanding that you cannot keep someone in a room who's on Nyaope all day and say, you know, because of the cramps and all of that. So there was an intervention, but it wasn't sustainable. There was, you know, the National Drug Master Plan speaks to an involuntary intake where people would say, no, we can't do anything, even though he's smashing the house and he's beating up his mother, he's raping his mother. If you want help from drugs, it must come from you. Without understanding that we can still protect the family, we can still protect the grandmother, you know, by following through with an involuntary intake via the court system. But you would then go to the court and say, this is what the National Drug Master Plan says, and the court clerk will then tell you, no, we don't know about that, we don't do that here. So it was you even doing your homework about what needs to be done, but just no one's aware the implementation of this beautiful document. It's just not there. It was that frustration. And I think up until today, we still feel that. We still see that. I look at this community and, you know, it's sad. There's a lot of good stories to tell because I think in between all of this, what has happened, and people often say to me, you know, in trying to do good, people will say to me, you gave our community a bad name, because all our youth right now, we've been painted as drug addicts, as gangsters. And if you look at my Facebook profile since last week, I said, we are not gangsters. We are not drugs. It is just the fact that this community is very active, and we speak out and we speak up against the social ills and the wrongs.
And for me, there's no honor in hiding it. You know, I mean, trying to do, and it's unfortunately a thing that so many communities do, is that the shame that's attached to it. Stuff the shame. If you have a problem with, you know, as you had mentioned, I mean, the long list of things, mothers having to stab their own children, you know, their own children raping them in some instances, and the long plethora of social ills that comes with this thing, rather deal with it and say, guys, we do have a problem. You know, it's pointless being the family that wears the tie and the pretty dress on a Sunday and goes to church and is all smiles. But there's molestation or sexual abuse happening behind closed doors. Open up, be honest about the situation, and then deal with it. That is what is needed in this instance. And I think at least you highlighted that.
Yes, I think it's needed and it's highlighted. But there wasn't much will at the time from you know, some of the officials. There wasn't understanding. So here you go as a mother, as a parent, you've now put all your dirty washing out on the line for the world to know, and you're still not getting the needed help. You know, and also, you know, you run the risk of being victimized by dealers and all of that. But I think at that time, I just couldn't care. You know, I always saw people say to me, you were so bold back in the day, going and kicking down doors of lolly lounges and, you know, having drug dealers throw you to the wall, and me just getting up and saying, I don't care even if you kill me tonight, but you're not going to sell drugs to my child. You know, and them just saying, get away, yeah, we're going to shoot you. And I said, you can shoot me, I don't care, but you're not going to sell drugs. And to the extent where, you know, where you would try and buy drugs from a particular dealer and they'll say, your mother's crazy, so we're not going to sell to you. But I just, you know, just didn't have an ounce of fear for them. And I also found at the time that when we would go out as community, as LDAC, with some of the other leaders in the community, and we would dump walls, we would actually find drugs and we would find money. But when SAPs would go out, they'd be unsuccessful. So I could never understand that. It's one of the challenges that we also have in the community that we still have up until today. So, yes, there's a lot that still needs to be done. This is a mammoth task. We are now I'm so glad that we're having this conversation, because this month is actually a month where we're supposed to commemorate and highlight International Day Against Drug Abuse and Illicit Drug Trafficking on the 26th of June. And I believe that substance abuse is a new struggle that is facing the youth of South Africa.
But in a big way, yeah.
You have, in a very, very big way, wherever you drive, there's kids sitting under bridges and things like that, and you look at how it's affecting the economy and how picket-up bins are being stolen, how cables are being stolen. You know, load shedding, our lights don't go on because then there's cables missing. In these communities, you look at how the people who hijack, they use drugs so that they get that sort of sense of bravery and all of that. The destruction and the chaos that's been caused in this country, but it's not being recognized, and I don't know why. I don't know why there's not enough will being put, and why this month, with it being Drug Awareness Month, why are we not seeing that yellow ribbon, and why aren't we having the conversation? With HIV, we have the red ribbon during December. With cancer, it's another disease, we have the pink ribbon. There is something that is destroying the future of this country, and we are quiet about it, and it is Youth Month, an ideal time to highlight, to talk, and to educate South Africans around it. But we are not, the yellow ribbon is there. I don't know anyone is even aware of the fact that the yellow ribbon is a ribbon of awareness, education, breaking the silence, breaking the stigma, you know, all of that.
I mean, I'm actually, you know, I'm listening to you and I'm thinking to myself, you know, where did we go wrong and how did we get this wrong? And I'll probably try to push for that portion of the conversation just to understand where did the community go wrong, Where is it that families go wrong, and more importantly, the state that needs to provide the necessary support? Because I'm listening to your story. You were obviously not just an active citizen for the sake of the neighbor's child. You were an active citizen for your own child. But the one thing that's glaringly obvious is the letter that you wrote, and you'll tell me if I'm wrong about my assessment here, but the letter that you wrote was ultimately out of sheer desperation because you didn't know where to turn to.
Absolutely. Absolutely. It was like, is this really the state? I mean, I have exhausted all avenues of finding help, you know, and if I've tried everything, if I've tried the hospitals, if I've tried doctors, if I've tried rehabs, if I've made loans, if I've tried private schools, you know, take him to a private school, that's going to help. And you do that. And you know, the stigma at school, where no school wants to actually take your child because they heard that he's on substance. You know, I always say that addiction is the only disease that you get locked up for having, or that people, you know, people discriminate against it.
Mm.
I don't understand that, yet we say it's a substance abuse disorder and it's a mental disease, but there's no awareness around it. If it's a mental disease, why do we have to call the police? You know, if it's a mental disease, why are we giving our communities and our children criminal records? If it's a mental disease, why isn't Department of Health looking at alternatives and ways of where you can calm someone, you know, and wean them off the drug if it's a mental illness? We're saying things, but we are not putting things in place to actually address this illness.
Yeah. So let's talk about, you know, obviously the fanfare was there. The president came with, you know, accompanied by a couple of his ministers. As you and I discussed, there were police vans and hippos and goodness knows whatever else. It was just, it almost looked like a riot was, you know, was about to break out every time you drove into El Dorado Park. And lo and behold, you know, very soon after that, it just all disappeared and went to nothing, quite literally. So what I'd just like to know from you is what happened in that period? Because you said that the one thing that happened to you, I mean, here you are, ordinary citizen, ordinary civilian, and the president, a letter you wrote gets the president to come to your part of the world that seems to have been forgotten. You're hopeful that something is going to happen, and then 3 weeks later, people just disappear.
I think during that time, what happened to me is I found my passion and purpose in life. That is what happened. I had kids and users sitting on my wall in the morning calling me Auntie D. I think the fact that I just spoke up, everyone assumed that I was the answer to their problems, and I really wasn't. I was as helpless as what they were. But what I did, and I think I did this as a coping mechanism during that time, I used to collect kids in our community, those who wanted help, and used to come and knock at our door and just rush them off to Pretoria, to Cullinan, which was a free government-owned rehab, and just take them there. And that's how my journey started, by just collecting children in the main road that comes to my house. And parents would start phoning me during that time, my child's on drugs, please can you come and see me? And I would go there and talk to them without even understanding what I'm up against. But I just continued doing this year in. I eventually started an organization called the Yellow Ribbon Foundation, where we would support kids from school without disconnecting them from education, and try and keep them in school instead of removing them at a very early age of their youth, and try and redirect their thoughts, their activities, and their habits. You know, instead of only waiting for this person to hack out and start smashing the house 20 years into their addiction. So it was about me sort of trying to prevent and find it, to have an early intervention instead of a later intervention. And that is what happened for the longest time. I think back then, yes, like I said to you earlier on, we used to jump walls, do raids on a Friday, Saturday, Sunday, take people's drugs. We started doing campaigns, awareness, and all of that. And during the time, I actually learned a lot about substance use disorder. I did some research. I was then also nominated by the U.S. Embassy Barack Obama program as a potential leader in South Africa, and they sent me for just over a month to 5 different states in America to do research. Yeah, and I went to Seattle, to Washington, to Denver, to look at their best practices in terms of how they are dealing with substance abuse and what their NGOs are doing. And when I came back, you know, some of the programs that I was taught that side, I implemented in my community. But it was still difficult.
Mm.
It's still difficult. One of the other things that happened during that time, I remember friends of mine saying, geez, Dee, I know you wanted to highlight the drug pandemic, but I've never been arrested so many times for drunk and driving. So, like, thanks so much. Geez, I'm getting arrested Friday, Saturday, Sunday for drunk. We can't even have a drink in Elders anymore. You know, and some of them were actually saying, I had some techies that I was selling, and obviously, you know, the police took it. I had a boot full. I lost all my stock. I said, sorry, guys.
It shows. I mean, it has a broader community policing crime reduction impact. You know, the for lack of a better term, and I'm sorry because it's Rudy Giuliani, who's not a hero anymore, that introduced the notion, or at least popularized the notion of the broken window theory. You know, you start cleaning up all kinds of things within a community.
Mm-hmm.
There's a knock-on, a positive knock-on effect. Darlene, if you don't mind, I have Miles Budu from El Dorado Park also on the line. Just wants to give some quick input, and then I'll come back to you as well. You can respond to whatever he mentions, obviously, and then we'll continue the chat. Miles, it's been a while. How are you doing?
Good evening. Good evening, Gisho, and good evening, Caroline.
Good evening, yes, look, Mr. Miles.
Yes, I'm here in Eldos. I came here in 1991, and I've been moving all my life in all the parks. I'm from Aldra Park. I went to Reger Park, to Eden Park. I went to Valhalla Park, Valhalla Park. Now I'm in El Dorado Park.
You like the parks?
Yes.
Yes, ma'am.
I can feel her. I can sympathize with her. It doesn't matter how good the intentions was, how good the intentions are, and how good the intentions will it be in the future to try and bring down substance abuse, alcohol, drugs, gangsterism, bullying, crime, teenage pregnancy, school. It doesn't matter. For as long as you don't look like them, you are not part of them, you don't talk the language they talk, they will not send somebody to come and assassinate you. They will go around and close all the taps and hope that you will disappear into thin air. Whatever proposal you submit, they take it, they clone it, they copy it, and you cannot complain because it was never patented. And then they give it to some friend, some family member, and it then hits a snag because it was not your idea. You know, it's a pity that it is all 27 wasted years in this category.
I hear you. Miles, I mean, without interrupting, with all due respect, I think you're taking the conversation in a completely different direction. And with all due respect, and I don't know, Darlene, if you hold this view as well, I think it's not just El Dorado Park. It doesn't just boil down to what people look like. I think if you look at the degradation and the desperation across South Africa, and yes, if we look at race as a factor, there are many black African communities that are just as neglected as El Dorado Park or many other so-called colored communities. And I think that what we need to do is we need to call it out for what it is. Ultimately, it is sheer dereliction. I mean, it's local government elections now. And Miles Budu, you know for a fact that you're going to have a whole bunch of fancy suited politicians abandoning their suits, telling us that they're eating chicken feet for the votes and pitching up in communities in their party regalia and handing over all kinds of wonderful things like groceries and T-shirts and whatever else in exchange for votes, right? So I don't necessarily think it's just that it's because people don't look like you don't speak their language. I think that let's be quite honest and frank with ourselves that many communities, including communities like El Dorado Park, have been severely neglected.
Drugs has been a problem in colored areas throughout the country, throughout the ages and throughout the decades, my brother. This Nyaupe thing just came the other day, post-1994. We have all these years, right from the Kapsa Flatus to where we are now. Remember that El Dorado Park is the second biggest colored area in the country and the biggest in the province, and it's just neglect and marginalization from socioeconomic issues right down to cultural issues, my brother.
Okay, there was Miles Buru in El Dorado Park. So, Darlene, I mean, just picking up from that, again, I'm not denying and disagreeing with Miles on that basis. And I think that different communities have different struggles, for sure. And yes, the issue of drugs within colored communities has been a massive issue for some time now. But it's not sort of good enough for us to throw our hands in the air and say, because we don't look the same, we don't talk the same, therefore we're not going to get assistance.
But I also want to highlight the fact that I don't necessarily think substance abuse, if I've done a lot of outreaches in many communities, right? So what I've realized, it is as rife as what it is in El Dorado Park in any other community. The difference that you have your previously disadvantaged communities like Aldo's, and you maybe have your Santon. The difference is why the chaos isn't as rife and as hectic as your previously disadvantaged community, because in El Dorado Park, of the high unemployment rate, and obviously users have to steal and sort of, There's a lot of destruction that has to follow to enable the habit. But when a child in Santon is using, like for once, I just want to say also that addiction does not discriminate. It doesn't matter black, white, pink, colored, rich, poor, ANC, DA, whatever, drugs, it does not discriminate. Mm. It happens to the best of us. No matter where you stay, it is out there. Right? But what I do want to say, the fact that, you know, we can't say Aldo's is worse than Santon or Santon is worse, because we haven't done any research to qualify that statement, for starters. The reason why the focus has always been and known as colored communities, because those are the communities where people have to go out and steal to maintain their habits. So obviously the crime stats in those communities are a lot higher than your Santon cities, where someone child is getting an allowance and obviously they are able to have access to rehabilitation because their parents can afford 60.
And even tragically, I mean, the simple rule of thumb, and I'm simplifying it, but to a large extent it's what's proven true, is that the cheaper the drug, the more addictive and dangerous it tends to be. And when someone has the financial resources to go get themselves designer drugs, then you can, you know, take them to a cozy rehab center and have them go through a healing process. Whereas in your instance, you know, in a community where people are...
We don't have money. We can't afford to put our kids in these rehabs because we don't have money.
And those kids are the ones using the nyaupes, the heroines, and the tuk, you know?
Absolutely. Not even your pure heroin. Mm. That is where your nyaupes come in. Mm. Because obviously now everyone's trying to make a buck in the community. It's not even a case where you have drug dealers selling drugs. It is every second house, basically, because everyone's just trying to survive and everyone's just trying to bring something, a loaf of bread, onto the table. I mean, most houses that we have raided and lolly lounges, you know, when you confront these people and you say, but why are you selling the drugs on the gemeenskap? And they'll say to you, "Auntie, ma, wat moet ons eet?" That's the question. You know, they justify what they're doing. Wat moet ons eet, das nie geld. We've had many, you know, interventions where we try and close down a lolly lounge, and some of the communities will become up in arms because die persoon koop vir my 2 kg chicken. And here you are coming and you are closing this place. What are my kids going to eat tonight? So they actually tip off the people from these houses and they would stone our cars and rush out and do all sorts of things.
Because, that's what I wanted to address with you.
Dynamics are completely different.
That's what I wanted to address with you because, I mean, the one thing that I recall, you know, in your journey, especially as you said through 702, because it wasn't a once-off story and we disappeared into the ether. 8 years later, we're having this conversation, but, you know, in between there were multiple conversations that we had with you. And I remember that there was a time where you were literally being threatened. Your life was being threatened. There were accusations that you were trying to politicize and sort of become a political leader and you had to defend yourself and goodness knows. And as much as we want to say that, this, that, and the other, the fact of the matter is these are the issues that you unfortunately have to deal with, as you had mentioned, because within the community, some of the dealers are protected. And you know, that's what part of the problem is.
I think... Up until this day, what was intended, you know, to just help and do good. It, you know, people have to package the story in so many ways. You want to try and be, you know, converted. You want to do that. You're doing that for your own riches. You know, why are you bringing government here? There has to be an agenda. You know, why did you talk? Why didn't you let the councillor say something? Why didn't you mention the potholes? Why didn't you give our proposals? Mm. Why didn't you do? I mean, the night before the president came, I had so many people at my door coming to drop off proposals. I had pressure from pastors saying that I don't think you should address the president. Someone else should, because wow, you're able to represent the community. And for me, it was just this person. I just needed help, guys. I couldn't care about the potholes right now.
Yeah, I mean,
the pressure that I was put under was like, and then because I didn't mention the potholes, you didn't mention this, you didn't mention the unemployment, you didn't mention the electricity in the area, you didn't mention the development. You had a golden opportunity to address all of these things, and you failed us.
Wow.
That, I'm not a councillor, you know, I'm not. Mm. So I didn't think that would be the backlash, you know, and all of that. So it was, yeah, you're trying to help a community, and I'm not saying everyone, but you still had to deal with having to navigate and be emotionally strong. It's like almost you put more onto your plate now, because it was first just your family, now it's your family, and it's the community, and it's the dealers.
And it's the potholes, and it's the what?
And it's the potholes, and it's everything else. Lights would go off, and they would call me, please come and sort out the lights. Everything, I was... The expectation from me just was really, the demand was very high.
Okay, what I'm going to do, Darylene, because there's something I really want to get to, and it's an essential question. I'd just like to hear what your input is on how we deal with this at a community level. Remember I asked you that three sort of pronged question about the state, the community, the family, you know, who's responsible, but more importantly, what do we do then to fix the problem? What are some of your suggestions? But I have two callers on the line. I'm going to take them back to back with comments and questions for you, if you don't mind. Let's go to Helen in El Dorado Park first. Helen, good evening, and thank you for calling in.
Hi, good evening, and thank you for taking my call. Hi, Darylene. Hope you're well. I just want to say, Darylene, I salute you. Regardless of the backlash and criticism and being ridiculed and negative and whatever else, you kept going. You kept pushing on, and you kept on doing what God has placed on your heart. And therefore, I look up to you. And, you know, in life, it's obvious we cannot please everybody. Nah? So that's what makes dynamic and different. The fact that you did not give in to the naysayers. You are my role model, and I love you, Helen, honey. Thank you.
Thank you, Helen. Thank you, Helen. Unfortunately, I'm going to cut it there because, unfortunately, I think the radio was on in the background causing some feedback. Let's go to Cherylise in El Dorado Park. Cherylise, good evening.
Good evening, everyone. How are you all doing?
Great stuff. I hope you're good as well.
Fantastic. Auntie Dee, the question is posed at you. So what substance use disorder? There's so many questions about free rehab, yet we have support groups, and our people are not willing to educate themselves, but rather than just ask the question of rehab, cheap rehab, can we just maybe touch base on that?
Okay, so what do you want, what do you actually want to know, Bobby? I'm not sure, I'm not clear on the question.
So what I'm saying is, we're already offering our support groups, so that they can journey with us and learn and educate themselves and empower themselves.
Okay.
Yet there's some people that doesn't want to go down that route.
Okay. Can I just ask you a quick question there, Cherylise? Now, with these support groups, I mean, do they assist with some of the other secondary functions that one needs? I mean, and you can correct me if I'm wrong there, Darylene, but, you know, it's medication, it's therapy, it's a whole bunch of stuff. You know, if someone is physically and mentally addicted to a substance, a support group is great, but they need other interventions as well to ensure that they're actually going to stay off the stuff. So do the support groups offer that, Cherylise?
Okay, no. Okay, Auntie Dee, will you answer that?
Okay, first, I just want to acknowledge Helen and to say thank you. I'm so humbled by your kind words. it really means a lot, because sometimes you feel that you're making no impact, if but at least knowing that I can just inspire other people also to become active citizens in their community, that is really means a lot to me. Shirley, in terms of your question, what you are asking, in order for anyone to bring about a change, you need to understand your product and you need to understand what you are dealing with. Support groups aren't necessarily there to do and to, it's not the magic wand to bring about the change. But support groups will educate you and it will allow you not to journey. It will open your eyes. I always say I have these support groups so that parents don't have to follow in my footsteps in terms of wasting so much resources. So attend the support groups so that you can better understand what you are dealing with. So that you can understand that there are different stages of addiction. There's a user, there's misuse, there's abuse, there's dependency. A lot of people like myself, you just hear someone's on drugs, the first thing they say is, "Ons nodig 'n rehab." And many times you don't even understand that this is because they haven't tested this person, this is a heroin user. And you take a heroin user and you place him into a rehab in the community that does programs, but this person is actually at dependency stage and needs medical intervention. If you take someone who's just experimenting with weed, like a lot of our learners, you know, you take that person and you put that person in a rehab and you pay $60,000 because someone says it's drugs and you need a rehab and whatever, instead of just putting that person in an outpatient program because they are young and keeping them connected to their education and journeying with them, you know, and doing regular testing at home. So, yes, we may not be able to help everyone, but we can guide you so that you don't follow, you don't derail, if I can call it that way. We can guide you and we can tell you, this is the different types of treatment, the different types of intervention, you know, that you have. You have outpatient, you have inpatient, you have these programs. We can guide you and we can say to you, you know what, many times when our loved ones return home from rehab, we celebrate, we buy cake and cold drink, and sometimes we even have parties. And at these support groups, you will then find that some parents, some of the users will say, you know what, I actually told my mother I couldn't go to movies because that was a trigger for me, because we used to use in the back, we used to bunk school and go to movies, and that's where we used. So me going back there would be a trigger for me. So it educates you. It educates you where someone would say that, you know what, I have to actually inform the doctor that I was a user so that I don't get meds that would trigger me. Do we know that? Are we aware of the fact that, like, if you cook certain foods, you know, certain oils, sweets, it just puts you on another high, and the person, you've just spent 60,000 rand now in the most expensive rehab, and the person was on a proper diet, nutritional diet, and they come home and they eat the same junk food. You reverse everything the rehab has done. So when we are saying that addiction is an illness, we need to understand the illness before we can help. So that is why we have to come to these support groups, so that we can educate you in terms of what does the Children's Act say when a mother has four kids and she's on drugs and she doesn't want help. Do we deal with the mother or do we deal with the children? We deal with the children because those are the people who are in urgent need of care and protection. They are the vulnerable. And when we remove those children, you get the social worker in there to protect and put those kids in a place of safety. You'll find that the mother will then book herself into rehab. So there's different ways of dealing with substance abuse in the family. You know, I often speak to family members and I say to them, you know, have you ever noticed how some of our kids greet their friends on the corner, always with the elbow? They always say, "I wear." There's always a hug. There's always that sort of "Ulaikada." But when they come home, do we as family members ask them how they're doing? What is the one thing that keeps a lot of users stuck in addiction? It is unfulfilled emotional needs.
Yeah.
Do we hug? Do we say, "I love you"? You know, what is it that we're doing? And we're saying, "Don't go back to those friends. They're not good for you." But those are the friends who ask
where they get the emotional support from.
Can I help you with anything? Where they get emotional support from, and they're not being judged.
Darlene, I just want to ask you very quickly, because we literally only have 5 minutes left, and it's unfortunate. It's because of time. unless what I can do is I can make arrangements to keep you on after the 10 o'clock Eyewitness News. That's assuming that you're okay with it, but because I have another interview lined up, and I'll maybe keep you for just a couple of minutes, but we'll chat about it offline. What I just wanted to know from you, and which is essential, is look, what do we need to do from your experience? What are some of the resources that we need? Let's forget about the fact that there is no budget, that there is no whatever. What do we need to start working on to be able to stem this tide of drugs and to be able to deal with the situations that erupt in communities such as Aldo's within the context that you set out earlier, where it's people without socioeconomic access, the drugs are cheaper, it's accompanied by crime, and you know, you still have the added burden of dealing with lolly lounges, community pushback, and all that. How do we and corrupt police, by the way, we didn't even get to talk about that. How do we deal with that entire plethora?
You know what? I won't be able to answer it just by giving one sentence. It, you know, one has to break it down: the family, government, civil society, NGOs. But for one thing, there needs to be synergy between everyone. For one thing, I think that for many years you've only had the focus as only being on Department of DSD, Social Development, and SEPs. What about all the other 20 odd government departments? Where are they? What are they doing? What is their mandate?
Including education, by the way.
Including education, including health, economic development, in terms of upskilling. What, when the user comes back from rehab, what is economic development doing to sort of support those people into fitting back into society? What is education doing in terms of ensuring that we don't discriminate against children who are using, ensuring that we are testing kids regularly at the schools like we do with HIV, diabetes, and any other disease? You know, what are we doing at the hospital? Do we have a designated ward that you can go to and say, you know what, this is where you get tested. If you are positive, this is the ward that deals with substance abuse disorder. Or are we saying there's no bed space? You know, what are we doing as Home Affairs? Are we closing our borders? Are we monitoring how many land strips do we have coming into our country in South Africa? How many jets are landing, bringing the drugs in? There's a responsibility there as well. The justice system. Are we looking at the convictions? Are we looking at, do we need to tweak the act? You know, what is dealing? You know, who are we punishing? Are we punishing the user? You know, all of those things. We need to, it's such a mammoth task. It's going to take so much talking and education. And I'm saying, this is the mindset we should be talking about it, because it affects our youth. Like Gaylen Nkosi Johnson highlighted, the AIDS pandemic, and people were caught with bags over their heads, so they didn't know what to do. But it was conversations like the one that we're having tonight that educated us, where I now know I can drink from the same cup and I won't be HIV positive. You know, it's conversations like the one that we are having tonight. Education is, you know, our people perish, our country is perishing because of a lack of knowledge. You don't know your rights, you don't know the Children's Act, we don't know what to do. Basically, and everyone just assumes. But when we open ourselves up to information, we then empower ourselves and we would know what to do in our different spaces. And we would understand that we all have a role to play. People say to me, you know, this is a SAPS problem, and you're the activist, you're the advocate to do. And I say to them, you know what? What you can do, you might say that you cannot contribute, but you buying a toiletry pack for someone, somebody will say, Auntie Vilna, you have to khan mora. That person doesn't have their dignity. They don't have a bath soap. They don't have a toothbrush. Do you think they're going to go to rehab tomorrow morning? No, they're not, because they don't even have a bath soap.
So, Darylin, if you don't mind us doing this, right, can we continue the chat just after the 10 o'clock Eyewitness News? I promise you I won't keep you long, so that I can give you adequate time to address those particular issues, because I think this is one more factor that's left out of this. It's, I guess, the most difficult. We've touched on what the state can do. We've touched on the role that you as an activist, for example, plays in providing the information and the education. The final leg for me is obviously the family and the community aspect of it. You know, as an ordinary citizen, that person getting the pack of chicken, you know, from the dealer, that person who has, like you, had a child in the home that was an addict, and how do we deal with that particular situation there? Without any judgment, without any sort of preachiness, but just what in reality we need to do to be able to deal with this. I hope you don't mind.
702 on 92.7 and 106 FM.
Streaming on 702.co.za.
The 702 app.
And on DStv channel 856.
Wonderful conversation that we're having with Darlene James. I understand that I do need to wrap it up because obviously I'm moving on to another guest. But before that, I think this is essential because this is a conversation I've been yearning for years. And I'm really happy to have Darlene James on the line with me, of course. But the one issue that I really need to broach with you, Darlene, is, of course, what is then needed? I think you and I spoke to a large extent from the type of resources that are required. I mean, understanding what that as essential as, say, a support group is, that mm-hmm. rehab is also just as important. Medication, mm-hmm. and what are the resources that go into that? It's not just sending someone off and you know, hoping for the best, but mm-hmm. actually that there's a lot of work that goes into that. That's the one aspect. But then the other aspect to it, I think that's key, is of course the social environment that someone finds them in, themselves in. And you touched on that to some extent, where you were talking, for example, about the behaviors that we engage in, where someone comes out of rehab and it's a big party. And there's a chance, a probability, I guess not deliberately, but the very same people that I was, you know, using drugs with might pitch up at the very same party that my parents are throwing for me or my family is throwing for me. And those triggers may come up, the food and the whatever else. What role does the family have to play in ensuring that this social ill that we're talking about actually gets dealt with effectively and permanently?
I don't think there's that guarantee. We have that guarantee that it can be dealt with effectively and permanently. I think with any illness, there's uncertainty. Cancer goes into remission and suddenly the person is diagnosed again. You know, it's an illness. We firstly need to understand that. But in order for us to at least have some success, like I said, we need to understand. We need to be willing to support the person. And I think when the person feels there's actual support coming from the family, but in our community we have this thing, you just dare relapse and I'm done with you because I've tried, I've given my everything, I'm done with you. I'm putting you out to the dogs and I start giving you food through the gate, you know, and over the wall, and you need to sleep outside because people said in winter, sit om uit laat hy buite kan slaap, hy gaan 'n goeie les leer and you won't ever use drugs.
And it doesn't quite work like that.
No, it doesn't work like that. No illness works like that. No person wants to be a drug addict. I can say that without a shadow of it, you know, with knowing and having had many case studies. So I think from the family, it is education, it is support, but you need to understand and you need to know what you're going to get yourself into. You need to see those triggers coming, the relapsing behavior. A relapse doesn't just start and, you know, you wake up and decide you're going to relapse. There are so many triggers that actually, that leads to that actual relapse. So those conversations are so important, you know, while the person is undergoing treatment, for the family to attend those groups. What's a user, you know, to attend the sessions? What's a user at the rehab? But what happens, we dump our kids at these rehabs and that's the end of it. And we just say they've gone to visit a family member and they come back and this person has changed, but you're still stuck. So you then send this person and you say you need to go and work. This person starts a job without you knowing that money is one of the triggers. So you're forced to come off the drugs. Now you need to go and work. With their first salary, they're relapsing again because they don't know how to manage money. So
yeah.
There's just so much to talk about. There's so much to talk about the various treatment options. And like I'm saying, I can just speak and give my opinion based on my experience and my journey in terms of what are the, I will never ever do that again. That actually worked. That is the one thing that I should try. And it's a very difficult battle. It's a journey, a lifelong journey, but through the grace of God, it's not always rosy, but I'm getting there. My family's getting there.
But I think the key thing that I'm taking out of it is that from a community, family level perspective, what's needed is actual education. And then at a state level, the intervention needs to go beyond, as you said, just policing. I mean, policing is essential because it doesn't help that your streets are patrolled by the very same SAPS members who are protecting those people, right? The very dealers and you know, the people who, that are responsible for this, who are the main supply. But in as much as it's important and DSD has a role to play, we need to make sure that education actually means something within the community. We need to make sure that there's some form of economic development where the people start their own businesses, have jobs, or something to keep themselves productive and earn a living for themselves.
And I just want to say this in closing, and this is why I'm so pleased that I've been appointed to serve on the Central Drug Authority. I was inaugurated about 2 weeks ago by the minister.
Congratulations, by the way.
Thank you so much. I've always wanted to meet this board, and I said, I need to get to these guys. They're going to help me. They're going to tell me what to do and whatever. And today I serve on this board 8 years later. So this is one of the responsibilities of this board is to ensure that all government departments, civil society, and everyone actually plays their part and they do what they're supposed to do. So this board is responsible for keeping all those departments accountable and ensuring that they play their part in terms of the National Drug Master Plan. And hopefully we'll be able to do that now.
I hear you. And all the best with it. And you know, in our hectic conversation, I almost forgot to congratulate you. So thank you for reminding me again of that. It's well done on you there. I'm very quickly going to take Faisal, who wants to make a comment. He's been very patient and
okay.
I just don't want to be rude. Faisal, short and sharp. Good evening.
Yes, good evening.
Yes, you're on air. Go ahead with your comment.
Yes, so thank you so much. It's Faisal Jaffer speaking from El Dorado Park. I think tonight I just want to appreciate Darren Dean. Being a former work counselor, I just want to say that I think that that lady is taking a lot of slack in this community. A lot of people are continuously just attacking her. They're not appreciating the work that she is doing and that she has been doing in El Dorado Park. And I think that I just want to say that I enjoy my time working with her, and she should just you know, keep it up. And even though I'm no longer a counselor, she still has my support, and she must keep doing it. Thank you.
Awesome stuff. Thank you so much, Faisal.
I appreciate you so much. Thank you, counselor.
Awesome stuff you heard there. Thank you so much for your time this evening. And all the best and good luck in the new position and in the new role. Obviously, I know you're going to be frustrated to some extent by issues of bureaucracy, but at the same time, this gives you an opportunity to make the impact that you, you know, so desperately would like to make. And clearly, you yourself, I mean, just as a final thought, you've evolved, you've grown within this journey from being helpless, inverted commas, all the way through to being someone that's seen as an authority in the space. Well done on you.
Thank you so much for having me. Thank you very much. This conversation means a lot to me.
Only a pleasure. Thank you so much. That was Darylene James.